mercy, caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see. I'm just a poor boy, I need no sympathy, because I'm easy come, easy go, little high, little low. Any way the wind blows doesn't really matter to me, to me. Mama just killed a man, put a gun.
Will you do the fandango? Thunderbolt and lightning, very, very frightening me.
Galileo,
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 Galileo
Figaro.
Magnifico!
I'm just a poor boy, nobody loves me.
He's just a poor boy from a poor family, sparing his life from this monstrosity.
Easy come, easy go, will you let me go?
Bismillah! No, we will not let you go.
Let him go!
Mamma mia,
mamma mia, let me go. Beelzebub has a devil put aside for me, for me, for me.
So you think you can stop me and split my eyes? So you think you can love me and leave me to die? Do this.
Oh, yes, indeedy. Few bands have embodied the pure excess of the 70s like Queen. Theatrical, brilliant, mercurial. There's never been another band like them or a frontman like Freddie Mercury. Their performance at the 1985 Live Aid concert was the stuff of legend. And their 1981 Greatest Hits album has sold more than 25 million copies so far. Still selling. Queen were one of the biggest 80s stadium rock bands. I had the pleasure to see them on an occasion. But the death of frontman, songwriter, and producer Mercury at the start of the 90s brought the band to a premature halt. The book The Dead Straight Guide to Queen tells the full story of the band and its members. It's written by Phil Chapman, researcher, writer and developer for This Day in Music. He's the author of Queen Song by Song, which chronicles the making of each of Queen's 15 original studio albums, and with detailed notes on every track on each item. So this is the man to talk about The Dead Straight Guide to Queen. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, Phil Chapman. Phil, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you with us. Queen, they have transcended what you would think your basic 70s rock band could ever do, and they're still relevant, they're still selling albums. 25 million copies of the greatest hits to date.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable. But I think their attitude right at the start, when they were nobodies, probably would have given an indication of what might happen if they ever got a record deal. They had utter self-belief and were prepared to sacrifice everything to get where they wanted to be.
So, I mean, how did it all start, Queen? Because they arrived in... I mean, I grew up in the 70s, and Queen were there or thereabouts, and pretty much a backdrop to my childhood. Was it late 60s they got together? Was it early 70s? How did it all come about?
Brian and Roger got together in the late 60s. And they met Freddie in the late 60s, but didn't form a band with him at that point. Brian and Roger were in a band called Smile with an old school friend and former bandmate of Brian's called Tim Staffel. So they were a three-piece called Smile. Freddie used to drink in the same pub as them. He was a friend of Tim Staffel's from college. And they met a band from Liverpool who travelled south to make their fortune called Ibex. Freddie wanted to join Smile. He always wanted to be in Smile, but it was a three-piece with three great vocalists, and they didn't need another one. So he browbeat Ibex into taking him on as their singer. He really developed his craft there, his singing craft. The stage craft was already there. I interviewed John Taylor, who was in that band, played bass in Ibex, and asked him the question, how long did it take Freddie to develop his persona? And he said, oh, no, it was always there.
I'm just imagining sort of a pre-Ibex or a pre-Queen Freddie Mercury drinking in a pub somewhere. He must have stood out a mile.
I know. And he always dressed completely over the top. He had a store with Roger Taylor at Kensington Market selling second-hand clothes. And Freddie used to take clothes from the stall to create an effect. So he'd walk into a pub and be dressed in some huge fur coat and a satin shirt. So he always stuck out.
So, but it was the 60s. So pretty much we're saying that Queen were brilliant musicians for a start, but also firm friends as well, rather than sort of the bands that kind of get together and get lumped in because he's not a bad bass player and he's okay on the drums.
Absolutely. They were already friends. John Deacon came along a bit later after Queen had already got through three bass players. But he remarkably slotted in. And became as close to the other three as they already were with each other.
So what happened with Smile and Ibex, or Ebex? I mean, how did they get together, and how did they dissolve and turn into Queen that we know?
Well, at one point, the Ibex boys and the Smile boys and all their friends and various other people were sharing various flats and sleeping on floors and sofas and all sorts of things. And Ibex got to the point where they felt they'd given it a good shot and it wasn't working, whereas Queen, or the Queen boys, what became Queen, never thought that. They were never going to give up until it happened, and that's what made them stand out. So the Ibex boys went back north. Smile was still going, so Freddie looked for another band and found a band comprising lads who were about 5 years younger than him called Sour Milk Sea, and he set about redesigning them. He took their songs and replaced their lyrics with his, And it brought about a great deal of discord within Sour Milk Sea, and they soon folded. And round about that time, Tim Staffel decided that he no longer wanted to pursue the same direction musically as Roger and Brian. So Freddie pounced and was able to finally get together with the guys he'd always wanted to be with. And they had a friend of Roger's from Cornwall who played bass, who they recruited as their first bassist, and that was the original lineup of Queen.
I mean, in the late 60s, the mid to late 60s is when Queen got together. An awful lot of sort of bands were running around London trying to make it big. It seemed to be the thing to do. You know, music was young and exciting, and every sort of full guys would get together and do a band. And a lot of them were doing that sort of blues crossover from the Yardbirds, from John Miles' Blues Breakers. What made Queen stand out, or were they just another sort of aspiring white boy playing blues?
They had a mixture of backgrounds musically and a mixture of influences. A lot of blues and soul. Brian was always a bit of a rocker, and he at one point aspired, I think, for Smile to be a sort of a power trio. He was influenced by Jimi Hendrix and by Cream. But when the four of them got together, and particularly in February 1971, when the definitive lineup was settled and John Deacon joined them, at that point there were four intelligent, forceful, strong-willed individuals, all of whom were creative, who ploughed in with their own ideas, and it created a unique blend of ideas and musical capability. And that, out of that came a sound that was like no other.
Indeed. How did they get then? How did they get a following? How did they make the breakthrough? How did they get the record deal?
Well, it's the old adage, the harder you work, the more lucky you get. They worked tirelessly. They played, they gigged all over the place. They had a friend who was part of the Ibex setup, who had moved back to Liverpool, but then came down to help them out because he believed in them. And he didn't know much about the business, but sort of appointed himself their de facto manager. And he hit on the idea of phoning record companies up around London and asking for their A&R manager, asking for the A&R manager's name, and then ringing off, and then later in the day, calling back and asking for the A&R manager by name, as though he already knew the person. And by using that technique, he got Queen in front of quite a few record companies. And another piece of fortune, but again, Queen had worked hard at it, was that somebody who had seen Smile perform gave them an opportunity to work in a brand new recording facility in Wembley called Delane Lee. And Queen were given the chance to play as loud as they could to test the soundproofing between the different studio facilities in Delane Lee. And in return for playing very loud, to allow them to do the soundproof testing, they were allowed to record a demo, which they then, with the help of Ken Testy, took round all these record companies. And then eventually, out of that, and some people from Trident, who eventually they signed with, having seen them at Delane Lee, when different people were coming around to have a look at the facility, all the pieces started to fall into place, and eventually they got a deal and were able to record an album.
And what was the album? How was the album received when it first came out? And I'm just sort of smiling to myself, because to say that the Queen were put together or were allowed to call a demo for testing the soundproofing, you kind of don't really think of Queen as a power group in terms of that noise, especially at that point, because some of the songwriting that Mercury put in later on was really quite delicate, and some of the stuff that Brian May put in there is often thought of as, if you like, fiddly fretboard stuff. But when you listen to stuff like, you know, Sheer Heart Attack and the Live Killers album, then they really do rock out.
Oh, yes, and even when they started to produce some of the more delicate stuff, they were still a loud band live. When they played the Rocky Numbers, they were loud.
So how was the first album, how were the first singles received? Was it an instant success, or did they take time, or were they at the right place at the right time?
No, they weren't at the right place at the right time, or they should have been, but the press didn't like them, because the first album was so eclectic that nobody knew how to pigeonhole this band. And the music press of the day didn't like bands they couldn't pigeonhole. So Queen got some pretty bad press There was one track on the first album, Son and Daughter, which had a little bit of a Led Zeppelin influence, which Queen admitted they were fans of Led Zeppelin and were influenced to an extent. But it was the only track that you could really ascribe any Led Zeppelin influence to whatsoever. But then it resulted in a bit of lazy journalism, and somebody said, oh, they're second-rate Led Zeppelin copyists, and then everybody else followed suit. The response from Queen to the bad press was that they just stopped talking to the press, which annoyed them even more. So that was the start of an ongoing mutual loathing relationship that went on for the rest of Freddie's life, really.
I mean, you've got to be pretty thick-skinned and pretty stubborn to say, right, that's it, I'm going to be sure of myself, I'm not going to talk to the media from now on.
Absolutely, and they were. There were two or three journalists who were kind to them and got the interviews, but Queen really didn't talk to anybody else.
People sort of think of Seven Seas of Rye as being perhaps their breakthrough single, but it was obviously the one that really, really saw them breaking through, and a massive hit was Bohemian Rhapsody, because of, I suppose, the production values and one of the world's first rock videos.
That certainly was the song that broke them to a wider audience, but they'd already gained a strong fan base prior to that. And Seven Seas of Rye certainly helped them with that, although it was very fortunate that it got the spot on Top of the Pops that really brought them to a lot of people's attention.
And what was a Queen live concert like? Because obviously, mid-70s, you have, glam rock is going through its stage and it's transmogrifying into sort of punk and whatever. I suppose Queen's look and their love of the flamboyant as the 70s wore on and got a little more exotic and eccentric and prog rock came in, they were sort of perfectly poised to ride that wave?
They were. I saw them in 1975 on the A Night at the Opera tour, four rows from the front of the Bournemouth Winter Gardens. And they were, a lot of that concert was quite heavy rock. But they reproduced all of the harmonies, just the three voices. It was absolutely incredible. They were remarkable to see live in those days.
And also, you saw them at Night at the Opera, and then there was Day at the Races. They were pretty good on the sort of concept album and the idea and the look of the band at a time when, I don't know, now we everything is mass marketed and the look is really important. But perhaps Queen were the pioneers of packaging that all together.
I think they were. They knew exactly how they wanted to look, and they took to the record company, to EMI. They took all of the designs for all of the marketing material, for album covers, inner sleeves, and so on. They wanted control of their image in every aspect, and they got it.
You said that you saw them in the 1970s. Queen during the 70s was quite something to behold, and Freddie liked to party, to put it mildly, and the rest of the band did as well.
Yes, most definitely. There are lots of stories of the excesses of Queen backstage and in the after-show parties, and virtually all of them appear to be true.
They make Lynyrd Skynyrd look like a bunch of choir boys. But the thing was, unlike other 70s bands who crashed and burned, I mean, Queen were still writing the songs. Like I said before, the Live Killers album is one of the first albums that I think I ever bought. And as a piece of a band at the top of its form, it really was quite something. And then, in the 80s, they got even bigger. And whilst other bands were sort of fading out and all the prog rock bands were going the way, and even the mighty Led Zeppelin was petering out because of the death of Bonham, etc., Queen went from stage to stage, and the audience, I mean, Queen fans are fanatically loyal.
They are, yes. They were really, Queen were one of the first bands to have audiences singing along with them. You used to go to rock gigs in the 70s and people would stand there and shake their heads and maybe clap along to a few numbers, but that was it. At Queen concerts, the audience sang along and Queen responded, and they started to leave spaces for the audience to join in. And that's quite common now, but in the days when Queen did it, it wasn't. And it was really the fans that brought that about rather than the band.
I'm thinking now I'm here in the Queen Life Killers album where he says you booms can sing higher than I can. At one point.
Yes, quite yes, great moment.
And the music develops. You know, Freddie Mercury is out there. Shall we say having a lovely time? I think the best way we can say it on an afternoon show.
He
took those influences that he was discovering in Clubland and the London gay scene, and he brought them into the music as well in a tongue-in-cheek way, but also it made the music develop.
Yes, it did. All of the band were being influenced by different things around them, but Freddie in particular, once he discovered that more hedonistic lifestyle, that did influence some of his writing. He portrayed it in a very wry, tongue-in-cheek manner, as you say.
They'd already taken to the video world with Gusto with Bohemian Rhapsody. When they came out with Radio Gaga, I remember seeing that for the first time and being completely blown away by the synthesis of the music and the images. I mean, this was also a very important part of, again, the Queen look and the Queen sound.
Yes, I think because Queen never really did the Top of the Pops thing. They did a couple of standard Top of the Pops performances, but most of the time they were busy touring or recording, and so they continued to produce videos long after Bohemian Rhapsody. And by the time of The Works, they decided to really chuck some money at their videos, and they came up with some quite epic and in some cases very expensive productions.
1985. It's Live Aid. It's Wembley Stadium. It is the biggest music event. Everybody is involved. You know, Phil Collins is flying on Concorde from London to Philadelphia, and some say he should have just stayed in London because the concert was better. Now, you know, I was a something teen-year-old at that point, and, you know, I was a bit of a Queen fan, but a lot of the music press were very sniffy about Queen because they weren't really fashionable and trendy in the 80s in the way that perhaps, Paul Weller was in the Star Council, all that sort of thing. Queen took to the stage, and if there was ever a band who stepped up to the mark, that performance, I mean, I watched it actually this week just to get me in the mood for this interview. My goodness.
Yes, and it was no accident. They recognised the significance of the event, the size of the audience, and they were the only band who actually really treated that 20 minutes as a full-on, managed, controlled performance. They flew their international touring crew in from the States to help them put their on-stage production together. Even though it was just 20 minutes, they rented the Shaw Theatre in London for 3 days and built a stage to rehearse on that was the same dimensions as the one they would have at Live Aid. They put big clocks up all the way around the rehearsal stage so they could see the countdown and they could fit their set into exactly 20 minutes, including
wow.
Patter. They left absolutely nothing to chance. So by the time they got to Live Aid, they'd picked the perfect set list. They'd rehearsed it into the ground so they knew every single nuance of it. And when they hit the stage, of course, the crowd went wild and Queen just kept them there.
Absolutely. And also the way they went from the songs to quiet songs to loud, I mean, it really was, that's a defining image. I mean, people tend to forget that there was McCartney, there was Bowie, you know, they were all getting, Dylan was in Philadelphia. There was, you know, a small Led Zeppelin, pretty shambolic in over in the States. But you mentioned Live Aid, and everybody says Queen.
Absolutely, and quite rightly so. They stole the day.
They got a little flack a little bit later on, though, for bringing out It's a Kind of, on the Kind of Magic. Like, was it One Vision? They said they were trading off that Live Aid performance. Any thoughts on that one?
Well, I think there is possibly some truth in that, but they weren't the only ones to do it, and Queen have always been a savvy market-aware outfit, as they are to this day. And I don't think that it's a criticism that can just be levelled at them. You know, after all, they're professional musicians, they have a product to sell, and they contributed massively to the success of that day, so why not sell a record off the back of it?
And off the back of that came the Kind of Magic tour as well, which went worldwide. It was huge. I saw them in 86 on that tour as well. Absolutely brilliant performance. Everybody at this point, you know, Queen were living legends and everybody's favourite band, it seemed, and they absolutely didn't disappoint.
No, they didn't. I saw them on that tour as well, and it was a very different Queen to the one I'd seen back in 1975, but they really were absolutely in control of their world at that point. They were at the absolute height of their power.
The 80s turned into the 90s, and there were rumours about Freddie's health, but we weren't really ready for the shock and the suddenness of when his passing was announced.
It was the day before.
Yeah.
And he'd kept it to himself for as long as possible. There were two or three very close people who knew about it. He told his bandmates as late on as he felt he could, and the way he presented it to them was, look, this is what's wrong with me, this is the situation, this is what's going to happen, let's never discuss it again, I want to carry on working. And he worked right up until the end.
And, before Freddie Mercury, the only high-profile victim of the disease had been, I think, Rock Hudson. So it really was a seismic shock through the industry and the media and the world, really.
It was. And I think with the Freddie Mercury tribute for AIDS awareness a year later and the Mercury Phoenix Trust, which was launched off the back of that, it really, although the announcement was very, very late, it really did bring home the magnitude and threat of the disease to a much wider public.
With Freddie Mercury gone, and a frontman such as him, you could say there'd never been, it would have been very easy and understandable for the members of Queen to say, right, that's it, game over, we're going home. They certainly didn't need the money. But they kept going, and they kept going in a way that was admirable, because we've seen bands lose frontmen and members before. I'm thinking The Doors, and I'm thinking Lynyrd Skynyrd, and it sort of petered out. But when Queen got together and brought in guest singers and guest vocalists, especially with George Michael, it just seemed to work.
It did, yeah. So it was the tribute concert was a very special day, and I think it worked brilliantly. It certainly had the effect that the remaining members of Queen hoped for. Obviously, life after that, I think that they devoted so much of the year after Freddie died to putting that together, and I think it was part of their grieving process. And they then found themselves a bit high and dry afterwards. It must have been a dreadful anticlimax, and the awful truth of their situation will have come home to them very rapidly after that concert, I think.
But they kept doing a few bits and pieces. I think was it Paul Rodgers got involved, Adam Lambert's been involved as well. So,
yeah, I saw them with Paul Rodgers, and much as I like his voice and I like the music of Free and Bad Company, for me that didn't really gel, that particular lineup. Adam Lambert's a very different sort of animal. He's a real diva. He's certainly got the voice to deliver the songs. He doesn't try to be Freddie, but I believe that he is the right man to actually deliver the songs, as long as Brian and Roger want to carry on touring. And they don't show any signs of giving up yet. And when you look at the audience, a huge amount of Queen's current audience and record-buying fans were born after Freddie Mercury died. There was never a chance for them to see Queen with the original lineup. And I think an Adam Lambert show is as close as anyone is ever going to get.
And it just goes to show, again, it'd be very good to say, well, it's just the nostalgia, but the power and the strength of the songwriting and these great four musicians as they were then together really has shone through and stood the test of time.
Yes, it has, and I think it will outlive all of them and probably all of us.
It's a thought, isn't it? Why did you decide then at this time the time was right to do the book Dead Straight Guide to Queen? And where do you start? I mean, where do you start with a book like this? Because you've done this sort of thing before.
The Dead Straight Guide, the series, have a particular format. So there are three sections. The first section's the history of the band, the second section's the music, and the third section is all the trivia and ephemera. So I had a structure that I had to work to. But beyond that, I wanted to write something that die-hard fans who already know a bit about Queen would be able to read and enjoy and hopefully find a few things maybe they didn't know. And at the same time, somebody who likes Queen's music but doesn't know much about the band could find accessible, and they could dip in and out and find things out that they wouldn't have known.
And I mean, did you speak to, did you uncover any new information whilst you were getting the book together? I mean, who did you speak to when you were putting this to...
Well, you don't get to speak to Queen's members unless you're writing an official publication, because they like to have complete editorial control. So I was never going to get to talk to Brian or Roger, but I talked to quite a few people from the early days. I had a great morning with Peter Hintz, who was what known as Ratty on Queen's crew, and was the head of their crew for a long time, and he knows them better than just about anybody else. There are a few people who lived, ate and breathed Queen at close quarters for as long as he did. And so there were a few things I asked him that I thought, well, I've got the opportunity. And there are a few things I was surprised I'd not been able to find out before and I couldn't find in any of the other books written about Queen, such as Freddie Mercury's famous sawn-off microphone stand. What did it have a name? Right. And Ratty was able to confirm, yes, it did. The crew either called it the Wand or Fred's Prancing Stick.
That's
which was a great one. So the little bits and pieces like that I was able to find and put into the book, which are hopefully little nuggets that the diehard fans will find interesting.
That's superb. The book is called Dead Straight Guide to Queen, which is a great title as well. It's by Phil Chapman. It's out now on Red Planet. Phil, the people want to find out a bit more about you or about the book itself, they can download the online version from the Talk Radio Europe bookstore. But do you do the social media thing? Is there a website they can visit?
Yes, probably the best thing to do is go to my website, because that I update the blog there with anything I'm doing, like radio interviews, for example, and also all the social media links are there. So you can go to philbo.co.uk and find out more.
Just give me that one again, please.
That's philbo, philbo.co.uk.
And having done the book on Queen, it says in the press notes, and I don't know if you've seen these, Phil, but it says you love fish and chips, beer and ukuleles, probably at the same time.
yeah, that's true. I do love fish and chips, always have done. It's nice to wash them down with a pint of beer, and the ukulele is just a delightful instrument.
So can we look forward to sort of the George Formby Real Ale Guide to Fish and Chip Emporiums of the Northeast or something?
Maybe that should be my next project.
Phil, it's been a pleasure to speak to you. I can speak all day about Queen, as you probably guessed by now. The book is called Dead Straight Guide to Queen. Phil Chapman, thanks for your time today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Take care.
Tonight, I'm gonna have myself a real good time. I feel alive. And the world, I'm turning inside out. Yeah. I'm floating around in ecstasy. So
don't stop.
Having a good time,
having a good time.
Shooting star leaping through the sky like a tiger.
time. I'm having a ball.
Don't stop me now.
If you wanna have a good time.